The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Coronomics, the Spectator series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. Today's podcast features our panel, based around the world, who have selected a story that gives you an inside look at what's happening outside their windows. Robin Doolittle is reporting from Canada and an investigative reporter for the Globe and Mail. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Frederick Eriksson is reporting from Sweden and the economist and director for ECIPE. Robin, we'll start with you. Thank you so much for joining us. You're the first journalist that we've had on Coronomics from Canada, so we're really excited for your update. Obviously, in the international press, a lot of the attention goes to the United States for some pretty obvious reasons, including the leader at the moment and how the U.S. has fared during this pandemic. I'd say not as much attention is given to Canada. So I was excited to see that the story that you've picked from your publication, The Globe and Mail, focuses on what's been happening over the past few months in Canada, what's happened, and also what's gone wrong. So talk us through it.
Sure. Well, I'm really excited to be the first Canadian on your show. That's great. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the United States, and I think that's important because of our proximity to the U.S., we spend so much time in Canada kind of consumed with American news and comparing ourselves to the United States. So from that perspective, I think there's some people that feel like, hey, Canada's not doing so bad overall. In our response, we've had, you know, more than 100,000 cases, a little over 8,500 deaths. So I wanted to really get to this question of how are we doing? Did we do well in this pandemic? And I think that there's, you know, an idea of why didn't the government see this coming earlier? And it seemed to me, well, that's kind of difficult to pin it too much on the government because no one saw this coming. But I thought the only real way to know for sure is why don't I just call all of the smartest people in the country who specialize in infectious diseases, who specialize in coronaviruses before people knew that word, epidemiologists, virologists, microbiologists, and ask them the same sets of questions. When did you hear about the virus in Wuhan the first time? When did you realize it was going to be a big deal? When did you realize it was going to be what it is today? What step did you take at each point in the process? What did you do within your respective institution? And through that, I assembled a timeline of how the pandemic unfolded from the perspective of the scientific community, and then put that up against the public health response. And when you put them side by side, you can see where the government and the public health response was slow, and when they were slow, when it was unreasonable that they were slow, when everyone realized this was going to be bad, there was a 3-week lag period before the government in Canada really took action. So I think that overall our response has been fine, but we could have got ahead of this. We had time.
You're calling it Canada's lost months. Do you really think that the timeline is so problematic in Canada that there was really months that were lost in terms of tackling this pandemic? And what does it mean in terms of the way that Canada's been able to handle the virus? You don't have the same issues that many U.S. cities will have in terms of population density. It's a much more spread out country with fewer people in it. Can it just about survive these failings? Or do you think that the government will be in hot water when there's an inquiry at the end of this to see how they handled things?
There's a lot to unpack there. There's definitely going to be an inquiry, and we're definitely going to be in hot water. In 2003, the World Health Organization issued a travel advisory not to come to Toronto, the city where I live. That was actually my first year that I moved to Toronto because of the SARS outbreak. Canada, is particularly Ontario, the province I live in and the city I live in, Toronto, bungled its response to SARS. We had 2 outbreaks here after getting rid of the first one, and there was a second flare-up. And after that, there was a series of inquiries and reports and recommendations for how we were going to be better prepared for the next pandemic. So most of, in my investigation that I did, so many of those mistakes that were made during SARS have been repeated with this one: lack of communication between between jurisdictions, confusing guidelines, waiting too long to make decisions. The story is called Canada's Lost Months, but I really think this could easily be called the world's lost months. What I found, and you know, with few exceptions, I think everyone kind of made these mistakes. So many experts, and therefore public health experts and government, thought that this was under control in January, that China had taken extraordinary measures to contain the virus, that although the numbers were climbing overall, it was 99% contained within China until the middle of February. And at that point, the numbers were actually coming down. So it looked like actually the virus was on its way to resolving. Each person that was infecting fewer than one other person with it. But then there was these tipping point moments when people said it was obvious. So that February 20th around then was the real date that every single expert that I spoke to said there is no chance this is not going to circle the globe and no chance it's not going to be bad. And that's because around then is when the first cases out of Iran were detected. And Canada actually detected one of those cases. And it's because Iran was a country where no cases had been reported. So there was community spread and it had no public health infrastructure to deal with that spread. So from that point on is really when the world should have been screaming, locking things down, talking about social distancing, getting the public ready for what was to come, and possibly getting ahead of it before it was out of control.
Jennifer?
Yeah, so it's interesting that you bring up SARS because we've spoken about this in previous episodes, and we've talked about how particularly governments have learnt from the SARS epidemic. Of course, Hong Kong is much, much smaller than Canada, but the government was relatively successful in learning those lessons. So I was just wondering, you mentioned that there have been repeated errors, but why do you think that is? Why do you think the Canadian government was so unprepared for this?
I think the big failing for everybody, frankly, was genetically, SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 is very similar to SARS-1. There's a big difference though. SARS-1 seems to be, from my reading of this, the most contagious kind of after you show symptoms. So that's why so many healthcare workers became sick with SARS, because you're shedding the most virus many days after you've developed symptoms. With COVID-19, there's new research that suggests you're shedding the most virus in the days before or at the time that you develop symptoms. This whole misunderstanding around asymptomatic spread is what just completely derailed the world's response. We approached COVID as if it was every other virus where, like, you're probably okay until you're showing symptoms. And with COVID, it's actually the opposite. It seems to be like really early on. So you can see the problem. If you're trying to do a containment, which is identify every case, isolate those people, trace those person's contacts, isolate those contacts before they can infect someone else. You see the problem if you're contagious before you show symptoms. So that's, I think, what really went wrong. Canada did a lot of things right. We definitely moved well ahead. Like, we took the lessons from SARS and did a lot of things well. If this had been another SARS, we would have been fine. But COVID is just much more contagious, and we weren't prepared ultimately to take bold, risky action because public health bodies are afraid, you know, for political reasons, I think, of no one's going to pat you on the back if you scream, we need to shut everything down, and then nothing bad happens, right? You'll pay a cost for that. And that's what I think needs to shift in this new world where we recognize that these types of threats are going to happen again as we encroach on animal habitat with climate change. These wet markets aren't going away. So we need to be prepared to take bold action in the future.
Frederick?
Well, thanks in the first place for sharing the article. I thought it was a very, very interesting read. And I think as you said, it confirms sort of many of the stories that we're also seeing coming out from other parts of the world, where journalists and experts have discovered same type of mistakes and same type of failings in public health authorities. My question, however, is about Canada and the regional spread and the regional statistics coming out sort of about pretty wide varieties in the number of deaths in different regions. And if I recall it correctly, I think Quebec have had much more problems with the virus than other parts of Canada, with I think more than 60% of all the COVID-related deaths have been happening in Quebec. this regional variations that we see in the infections and the deaths, what's behind that?
So there's a few things. So Canada, you know, is a country of provinces and territories. One of the big problems that came up with how Canada could mount its response was, you know, in the UK, you have, I believe, the NHS, and you set a strategy for the country, and it's everywhere. In Canada, each of the provinces is responsible for handling healthcare, not the federal government. The federal government can set things around the Quarantine Act and borders. They can set a tone. They can release guidelines that places can take or leave. So each province mounted its own response, and you've seen real variation as a result of that. British Columbia, our westernmost province, has done by far the best. They had early cases, they contained them, they were very proactive, they were checking for community spread, they were testing really widely. Ontario struggled on testing widely, on getting a test going. We had reagent shortages to mix the tests. We were less proactive in a big way. And my story is really like a kind of a story of how different provinces mounted this response. And then with Quebec, yes, Quebec has had more cases than the rest of the country combined. I think something like 20% of those cases are related to long-term care. The big thing, you know, after interviewing everyone that I found with Quebec, was they had their March break, so their school break, 2 weeks before the rest of the country. And it was the first week of March when the world still hadn't quite woken up to this. And people went to, you know, the US and people went to Europe. The virus that's in Canada, what they see so far, is from Europe and the United States predominantly. So people went away to Italy or Spain or France and then came back and brought the virus with them. And they came back to Quebec 2 weeks before the country shut down. So pretty much the consensus is that because of the way exponential spread works, Quebec's fate was sealed before they really did anything. No one has many complaints about their policies overall. And there's just one more point I wanted to address. I don't know if we can say that the scientific community failed in COVID. This is a novel virus. It's never been seen in humans before. And this is the challenge when you're trying to mount a public health response where the science is changing every hour sometimes. And you can't wait for things to be solid before you make a decision. Because if you're basing your decision on last week's news, you're already behind. You have to kind of be okay with taking risks and being wrong for the good of public health. I think that's where you have actually seen the failures, is that people are too concerned about being absolutely right for fear of criticism. And that's one of the things that's contributing to making people sick and dying.
Robin, thank you so much for your time. I know you're leaving us now, so thanks for joining Coronomics. I'm now going to move across the pond to Frederick, who has selected a story from the Sunday Times about Sweden in isolation. And it's a bit of a funny one because it's talking about what it means to be self-isolating and alone in Sweden, despite the fact that the country never really experienced an official lockdown. So talk us through that.
Yes, I think it is an interesting read. It's from the Sunday Times, as you said, and it's written by a half-Swede, Louise Callahan, who grew up in Sweden but now works as the Middle East correspondent for the Sunday Times. And she got sort of accidentally stuck in Sweden during the pandemic. And of course, now it's very difficult to travel from Sweden since we have restrictions on traveling from other countries, which means we cannot go into Denmark unless we work there and have sort of a particular approval in order to get into the country. I find this story interesting because we have been awash lately with lots of different articles trying to get into the soul of the Swedes and trying to understand why Sweden decided not to lock down as many other countries did. In the past weeks, that story has changed pretty strongly and has now sort of been we've seen sort of lots of different stories from especially foreign newspapers trying to understand sort of how the high death toll basically work in a country like Sweden, to what extent is going to change politics and perhaps the political culture of the country. Now, I think this particular piece is good because, I mean, she gives sort of a good flavor of how different people in the country have looked at the pandemic itself and the decisions by the authorities here not to lock things down. But there is also, I think, in this piece and certainly in many other pieces, a tone of sadness or a tone of lamentations where they are trying to figure out how this strange country in the northern part of Europe, a country sort of blonde, bland, homogenous social democrats, how they could really sort of go for such a laissez-faire style of policies, not to lock things down. And I find this interesting because, I mean, I have lived sort of with one foot in Sweden and another foot outside Sweden for 25, 30 years now. And I've seen the country changing so much over these three decades. When I grew up in Sweden, I mean, it certainly was a country of collectivist, conformist type of social democrats that did have a pretty strong culture of moral superiority that was happy to lecture many other countries about in what way they're going to run their policies. But over the past 10 years, it's been sort of difficult to find that culture anymore. Sweden has become so much more individualistic, so much open and so much freer than it was 30 years ago. And it's this sort of gap between, on the one hand, a 1960s style version of what Sweden is that you can find in lots of foreign reporting these days and actual realities in the country. I think that gap is pretty interesting because it tells you quite a lot about how foreigners have looked at Sweden for a long time and what their perceptions about the country has been. A lot of these stories, I mean, there was a piece in the New York Times last week which was finding a way to get the word pariah state into the title about Sweden. And lots of sort of exaggerated versions of what's been going on over the past couple of months like that. But sort of at the heart of it, you have that sort of sense that people don't understand Sweden anymore. They thought this was going to be still a country which is, you know, semi-nationalistic in a sort of social democratic way, being sort of a moral superpower that was going to do all things right. And they can't sort of fathom the idea that the Swedish state has become sort of as complacent, as incompetent as states in many other countries have been. So that's why I found that interesting with the story, that even if I enjoyed reading this particular piece, there is a tone on which laments the decline of Swedish exceptionalism.
Jennifer?
I thought it was really interesting too, because you mentioned that there's this gap between how the international community view Sweden and of course how Swedes view themselves and their government. So what would you say are the main criticisms towards how authorities have handled the coronavirus?
I think sort of there's pretty solid consensus around the view that the Swedish government plus Swedish local authorities failed to protect nursing homes and protect the elderly. I mean, that was the main ambition of policies when we began with different restrictions and going towards very strong advice on social distancing in early March. The entire policy was basically targeting protection of vulnerable groups. And when you look at the statistics at the Swedish COVID death toll, you will find that a substantial part of all the deaths come from nursing homes or for elderly people that have home care. So obviously something failed here. And I think there is already sort of a strong, I wouldn't call it consensus, but close to consensus about where those failures happened. And it was sort of a similar situation as we've had in countries like the UK and Belgium, where nursing homes, staff in nursing homes, they lacked access to PPE. Once they started to get PPE, they weren't trained how to use them. We had problems around the advice coming from the government on, you know, how do we deal with situations where the staff working in the nursing homes can be asymptomatic and they're going to spread the virus even if they don't show any symptoms themselves. And there weren't sort of strong enough advice to sort of employers and nursing homes employers on how to deal with these situations. So I think there everyone is already in a broad understanding about the factors behind the high death toll in nursing homes and the high death toll with people that have home care. On the issue of the lockdown, the opinion is still highly supportive of Sweden choosing a more open type of model. You'd find sort of that still 60% of the country thinks Sweden made the right choice in going for a softer version of lockdown. 20% think that Sweden went too far and that we damaged the economy as a consequence of the strong social distancing measures that we introduced. And roughly 20% are arguing that we should have followed the example of other countries and locked the country down. So in that sense, I don't think people generally are looking sort of at Sweden thinking that there was only one strategy and you can only have one opinion about it. Either you were in favor of it or against it. We can see sort of different type of strategies, different type of instruments. Some were successful and some failed.
Fredrik, I was going to ask what the public sentiment was like in Sweden right now, because you're starting to get reports, at least here in the UK, and I'm sure elsewhere, that there's growing disgruntlement or discontent with the way that the government handled things in Sweden. But are you sensing that? It strikes me that you've just flagged that the majority of Swedes are actually still quite happy that the lockdown was more or less voluntary.
Yeah, but I think even here, I mean, people sort of make distinctions between different actors and between different policies. We had a pretty unpopular government when the whole pandemic started, and suddenly the support for the government basically went through the roof during these weeks in March and April and to some extent early May, when things were being seen as they were handled competently by all authorities and by the government itself. What we've seen sort of over the past 6 weeks is increasing evidence that the government itself has failed. I mean, they've failed to provide resources to set up a mass testing. They failed to issue advice to nursing homes in time for them to prepare. This is where a lot of the criticism is coming now. And you see many other parties are now becoming more vociferous about all these things, but none of them, apart from one country, which is the far-right party, none of the other opposition parties are saying that they would have preferred the country to have locked down in March or early April as, well, the rest of Europe was doing.
Well, speaking of lockdowns, I've selected my article this week from the Leicestershire Live website, which is local press here in the UK, but very topical this week because Leicester is looking at experiencing what isn't exactly the first local lockdown in the UK, but certainly a lockdown suspension. And by that, I mean they are not going to get the same lockdown easing and liberalizations that the rest of England is expected to get this coming Saturday. Pubs, restaurants are reopening, social distancing measures are changing and becoming more flexible, but Leicester has seen a spike in increases recently in terms of COVID-19, and so they're not going to get those same liberalizations. They're going to have a two-week postponement. And it's interesting because this is causing political issues for the government as well as technical ones. One of the Labour MPs in the local area is actually encouraging the government to do a far stricter lockdown in the area. They're saying it's too dangerous. You shouldn't take the risk. You should just go straight back into putting people back inside, staying at home and not going out and about. I think this will put more blame at the government's door than it would if there were more agreement across the political parties like there was at the beginning of the pandemic. Because if things do go wrong and they can't get the virus under control, the fact that they didn't do a stricter lockdown, I think, would be thought of quite negatively. But it also highlights an issue that we've spoken about previously on the podcast, which is that many governments just simply aren't prepared to properly track and trace, as is done in Hong Kong and other Asian countries. Our virus tracing app is not going to be online until the autumn at least. So we're relying solely on contract tracers to get the virus under control and to make sure that it doesn't spread. So Jennifer, I'd be really interested to hear from you how you receive stories like this. I mean, it's actually quite shocking to me the poor decisions that have been made leading up to a moment like this. We're just not all that sure whether or not we can do local lockdowns. Whereas in Hong Kong, as I understand it, it wouldn't be much of an issue.
Yeah, that's so interesting because from my understanding in the UK, you've been under lockdown for a few months now. And I can understand the public becoming tired of staying at home all day, not being able to work and that kind of stuff. Whereas in Hong Kong, I guess we didn't really go into lockdown like they did in other countries. We were told to work at home for several weeks, and you know, civil servants were told to not go into work into the government buildings. However, this was people adhered to it pretty well. But having said that, it's worth me caveating that by saying that we weren't under those restrictions for that long. While of course we do have other restrictions like not being able to gather in a group. Now it's been expanded from 8 to 50 people. So that's quite a big expansion. But while we have these restrictions, we were still relatively mobile. People were still allowed to leave their homes, go out for however long they liked. While, of course, the government did advise them to take these precautionary measures. And as a result, and because of the travel restrictions and how well Hong Kong has been able to contain the spread of the virus, we're now loosening those restrictions. While, of course, we still have some travel restrictions, but the government is setting up these travel bubbles to essentially facilitate business people to travel between Guangdong, Macau, and now Taiwan. So it's really interesting to compare it to other countries that have had a completely different experience. And again, as we've said in previous episodes, this comes down to Hong Kong's experience with previous pandemics and the fact that many Hong Kongers do live with the trauma of SARS, even prior to the coronavirus. Just you will see kind of adverts in public transport saying to wear a mask when someone is feeling ill to avoid infecting other people. And this was prior to this year. So it's not surprising, but it is interesting to see how other countries have really stumbled in this sense.
Yeah, at no point in the pandemic up until now did I think I would be lucky to be living in London and not Leicester, in the sense that London was thought to be one of the hardest hit, was going to have the hospitals overrun at one point, you know, a crowded city, a more dangerous place to be. But I can't imagine going backwards, not forwards, in terms of lockdown easing right now. But still here in the UK, Frederick, quite a lot of people think the government's moving too fast. There will be people in Leicester and elsewhere who would actually like to see a pause to this easing, maybe even a rollback. But as you've mentioned on the podcast today, that feeling might also not be totally understood in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, there are going to be sort of people all across the world who thinks that the right way forward is basically to have societies locked down for at least the rest of this year. And you'll find scientists also in Sweden who are making that argument. So in that sense, I don't think sort of it's an unheard of view. What I do find troubling and what is going to be interesting, sort of see how we move forward, especially after the summer, is how all these local lockdowns are actually going to work. I mean, we've seen so far, for instance, in Gütersloh in Germany, where they discovered an outbreak at a meat packaging factory 2 weeks ago, and they imposed a local lockdown there. That didn't turn out to be a very, very good experience, partly because the summer has arrived. No one likes the idea of being sort of locked into the homes. You know, given the regional variations we've seen with the virus, you know, how it's infected regions in a very uneven way, it basically means that we are most likely going to have lots of different regional outbreaks coming in the autumn. In some of the large cities, you know, like London, Stockholm, Paris, it's probably the case that we have already reached a level of immunity which is going to have a depressing effect on the virus if it begins to show up again in the autumn. But in other parts, outside the main cities, I think it's going to be terribly difficult to contain the virus, especially if you haven't built up immunity levels that will help to protect, at least as a first line of defense. So what does this sort of say about the UK capacity to manage regional outbreaks in the autumn? How easy it's going to be for local mayors or for the government to instruct local mayors to basically lock societies down, even if the rest of the country isn't going to do that?
Yeah, I think a lot of doubt has already been cast on our ability to do local lockdowns. And the other issue, of course, are the inequalities that come with it if you're having to shut down entire economies in certain areas and not others. Of course, countries would like to avoid national lockdowns, but it does present some economic and political issues. And I think on that note, Jennifer, we'll move to your story in the Asia Times about quarantine centers, which I read not only as a story about COVID, but also potentially as a story about inequality and the migrant workers that are in really difficult circumstances often when they come to Hong Kong. So talk us through it.
Yeah, so the article I selected was from the Asia Times. We previously spoken about, I think, minorities in Hong Kong and how their experience with the coronavirus has differed from other locals in terms of how they are treated by authorities or how they say their well-being is not prioritized above people of Chinese descent. So I don't think this is exclusive to Hong Kong. However, what the article focuses on is specifically migrant domestic workers, and there's a fairly substantial population, percentage of them in the population. So there are some 400,000 living and working here. Many of them are women from the Philippines and Indonesia. So if you're employed as a maid, as a foreign domestic worker in Hong Kong, you're required by law to live in with your employer. And then on your weekly rest days, oftentimes you'll go out to visit your friends in large groups, eat and have fun with each other. So you can imagine that they're in pretty close contact with other people, and it's difficult for them to socially distance. And actually, at the beginning, many of the confirmed cases documented by the Center for Health Protection were migrant domestic workers who caught the virus from their employer after they had traveled back from overseas. So not so much anymore with the travel restrictions, but certainly in the early days. So with that in mind, the Asia Times article looks at calls from local lawmakers and employer groups to set up these, as you say, these centralized quarantine centers for what they expect will be thousands of maids coming back from the Philippines in the coming weeks. And this has really sounded the alarm for some people, because around 7 people in Hong Kong had tested positive for the virus after traveling back from that country. And this later prompted the Labour Minister to reveal that the government is considering this ban on home quarantine for returnees from the Philippines, because of course they live with their employers. So naturally this has led to outcry from rights groups and trade unions, who say that this is yet another curb on the rights of domestic workers in Hong Kong. And this is not a new thing. So for many years the government has been criticised for failing to protect this percentage of the population from, you know, abuse, being underpaid, given inadequate food, living spaces, and enough, if at all, any rest days. So, and it's really interesting because the article quotes a lawmaker, Eunice Young, who expressed concern over the inability of employers to provide, for example, separate bathrooms for quarantine maids who have just returned from their home countries, because, of course, Hong Kong has very limited living spaces. And so Eunice Young has previously gotten into some hot water with her comments on domestic workers back in, I think, 2018, where she essentially said that them gathering on their rest days affected the environmental hygiene of those public places. So, you know, she later apologized for those comments and tried to make amends. But of course, you can see the underlying tensions between these two communities. So, you know, with that in mind, it's worth remembering why these women come to, mainly women, come to Hong Kong in the first place. And that is to earn more money than they would do back home, so they can send it back to their families and pay for things like, you know, debts, living expenses, and their children's tuition fees. So these women make huge sacrifices to live abroad for such long periods of time, and it's imperative for them to maintain a regular income. So back in February, when the Philippines had implemented a travel ban preventing the, you know, the inflow and outflow of domestic workers among other travelers, I remember interviewing several of these women who were essentially stuck in their home country and couldn't get back to Hong Kong. And, you know, they were extremely worried about their financial future. Many of them didn't have savings. And two of the women that I spoke to said that their employers were considering hiring new maids because, well, they're not going to wait indefinitely for their employees to come back. So when, you know, eventually President Rodrigo Duterte eventually relaxed these restrictions, and there's been this slow return back to work. But I think all of this is really interesting and puts into context this old argument over whether or not the rights of foreign domestic workers are given equal prominence in Hong Kong, and especially so during the pandemic. And, you know, this group contributes quite a bit to the local economy. They make up something like 3-4% of Hong Kong's GDP. So all the pandemic has done is exacerbate these issues, really, and brought them to the fore.
That's interesting, Jennifer. Obviously, here in the UK,
a few years back. You may not have heard, but Britain voted to leave the European Union. And there's no doubt that one of the major reasons that people voted out was immigration. The pandemic has kind of shone a new light on this. There's been overwhelming support to remove immigration surcharges for migrants who are working within the National Health Service. There's been a lot of support and understanding that migrants have contributed hugely, from delivery drivers to people who stock shelves to the doctors and nurses in hospitals. And basically at every income level, at every economic level of society, migrants have really been praised in the UK. Not to say that there aren't still divides and debates over this topic, but it has felt like a bit of a turning point. So it's interesting that in Hong Kong, it's exacerbated the issue. Perhaps it's because there wasn't a full lockdown, as we said before, but has there been any recognition of the work that migrants may have done during the pandemic to keep society going?
Yeah, and this has been an issue too, because particularly at the beginning of the outbreak, many rights groups and trade unions representing these workers were saying that foreign domestic workers were unable to take rest days because their employers wouldn't allow them to leave their homes. And it essentially meant that they had to work through 7 days a week without any rest because they weren't able to go anywhere else. Many of these workers typically, as I said before, congregate with their friends in public places on their rest days to enjoy each other's companies, but also to leave the houses where they both live and work. So this has posed a separate problem in Hong Kong, whereby many rights groups are saying that, well, their rights are being curbed, and this is just another way in which some of these workers have been exploited. And all the pandemic does just shone a light on it again.
Frederick?
I think the story is very interesting in itself. And of course, it prompts a couple of reflections from sort of my part of the world as well. I mean, what we've seen in Sweden isn't very different from what we've seen in most other countries that have been heavily infected by the virus, which is that there is a factor here where immigrant communities have been hit much harder than the population in average. So, it, for instance, in Sweden, you can look at, I think it is Somalis and people from Iraq, immigrants from Somalia and from Iraq. They are the two communities that have been the hardest hit by the virus. And there is sort of socioeconomic explanations to it. They live usually in small flats, in multi-generation families. They congregate in a way which makes the virus very easy to spread. But there's also another factor here, which is that authorities basically failed to do a lot more in the first place, just to inform in other languages than Swedish and English that the virus was here and everyone needed to take precautions in order to avoid getting infected. But now the story is also that, and it's partly shifted a debate about migration in Sweden as well, because a lot of people will appreciate the many contributions, especially to nursing homes, to healthcare, to schools and kindergartens that come from migrants, because they will disproportionately work in these care sectors than in other sectors. So that, I think, has also begun to shift the debate around migration a bit. When we entered this pandemic, we were basically on the tail end of this big migration conflict from 2015, where Sweden started out by being a lot more open than other countries in Europe for migrants that arrived from North Africa and from the Middle East. But then the tone of debate shifted quite radically. And ever since then, you can see that Sweden has been on this journey going for a lot more restrictions on migration. And I mean, they've already done it because the volumes of migrants arriving over the past years is so much lower than the volumes of migrants that arrived in 2015, 2016. So that was just sort of a long and way to say sort of that there are similar type of issues around migration, inequalities, and how that's going to affect new situations that have been prompted by a virus. What I found interesting with this story is basically that Hong Kong authorities are trying to come up with specific solutions to the problem. And perhaps sort of a 2-week quarantine is not going to be a good way of doing it, but possibly there are other ways of doing it. And what's the sense here? You know, is it possible to find practical solutions to solve this sort of this issue? Or are sort of a lot more people looking for much more radical solution, which is not to have migrant workers from the Philippines coming at all, or being more restrictive to migrants workers more generally?
So I think there's a general recognition of the need for migrant domestic workers in Hong Kong, not just for people in Hong Kong and the local economy, but also for the countries where those workers come from, where they hail from. And I think that's why the president of the Philippines decided to relax those restrictions for those specific workers a few months ago. And it's interesting because, as I've mentioned before, Hong Kong does have a 2-week mandatory quarantine policy for any returnees coming back into the city. And at the moment, because there are so few infections, many of those facilities are largely vacant. Many of the infections that we do have in recent weeks are all imported cases. Many of them are coming from Pakistan and other places overseas. So it seems that for the time being, Hong Kong does have the capacity to handle a few thousand domestic workers coming from particular countries. So I don't think it's so much a practical issue. Of course, if we do have a community outbreak and local infections, that will of course pose a problem. And, you know, in the past few weeks, there has been a very small cluster of infections with no traceable origin. So none of the people infected had any travel history. And that has raised the possibility of there being asymptomatic carriers in the community. But having said that, that cluster is still relatively small, and the majority of cases we do handle are imported. So this kind of specific solution to this group coming back from the Philippines, I think, is not that unprecedented. It's interesting how you highlight how this may change attitudes in terms of migration. But in Hong Kong, it seems to be, at least the general attitude that I sense, is that it's an issue of stigmatization, because foreign domestic workers, particularly from the Philippines and Indonesia, are often stigmatized. And so there's been a recent survey released by a trade union representing those workers saying that more than 80% of those surveyed said that they had experienced discrimination of some kind, whether that be they refused a particular service or even their employers saying, don't come back home because you've been out for too long and you may have exposed yourself to the virus, despite there being so few cases in Hong Kong. So there's an interesting discussion to be had over whether or how the government is approaching this particular issue and how it is looking to solve it. Because, as I mentioned previously, the Labour Minister is indeed looking at some kind of travel ban. So it's interesting how this will play out.
Very interesting, Jennifer, and I'm sure relates to wider political issues in Hong Kong now as well. Perhaps something to talk about in future weeks, but for now, Frederick and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you to Robin, who was on the podcast earlier. To hear more from the panel on next week's Coronomics episode, subscribe to our podcast channel, Spectator Radio. And if you're listening in America, you can subscribe to The Spectator at spectator.us/subscribe using the promo code Kate for a discount.
The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.